spend a lot of time recording the river and also paying deep attention to ambient pollution, runoff, the way water flows off of roads into the watershed, just sort of observing all these things and also thinking about cancer and blood and the lymphatic system and the way that tumors move and collect. And there were so many parallels, honestly.
Hello, you're listening to Overexposed, a podcast by Sonic Acts and Ya 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 Ne Ne Ne. My name's Arif, and for this episode I talked to Lucky Dragons, an ongoing collaboration between artists Sarah Rara and Luke Fishbeck. Lucky Dragons were a Sonic Acts Overexposed resident, and they presented a sound piece titled Sentences About Rivers and Cancers at the Sonic Acts Biennale in 2022. Their piece, as Sarah puts it in this conversation, addresses cancer, the experience of having cancer, and it thinks about water as a metaphor, but also as a physical and literal thing. The piece was installed on a bridge in the Amstelpark in Amsterdam, where a series of tactile transducers created vibratory channels that flowed together as listeners crossed from one side to the other. The arrangement of sounds distributed across these channels includes resynthesized field recordings of the Hoosig River, watershed recordings from above and below the water's surface, and a chorus of voices, spoken and sung stories. Observations and meditations on the socio-political and ecological entanglements that compose cancer as lived experience. As always in this podcast, I asked Lucky Dragons to bring us an artifact that moved their practice. They showed me a dusty volume of Elliot Porter photographs when we were talking on Zoom, which contains an image titled Trees and Ponds in Massachusetts, which is where Lucky Dragons relocated from Los Angeles during the pandemic and wildfires in 2020.
Hi, I'm Luke Fishbeck, and I'm one of the collaborators in Lucky Dragons.
Hi, I'm Sarah Rara. I'm an artist and one of the collaborators in Lucky Dragons.
Great, welcome. Thanks for doing this in the not so early morning in the US. Oh yeah, we always ask everyone to bring an artifact, and you send us a photo. And do you mind telling us a little bit about the photo?
Sure. So when posed with the question to present an artifact, I actually realized how dislocated we've been from objects and material things for really the past 2 years. We left our home, Los Angeles, during the pandemic, and it was a sort of flight from Los Angeles. There was also wildfires at the time. So we left our home in Los Angeles as is, with all of our most precious artifacts are still in the house, and we're currently in Western Massachusetts. And I looked around the house and the studio, and I really thought, well, nothing here has gained that sort of utility in my practice because I haven't been here very long. So I pointed to the fact that I've been in more of a virtual realm of connection for some time, but we selected an object that sort of speaks to that sense of dislocation, I guess. And maybe it's an odd choice, but it's been an image that's been troubling us and has sort of entered the piece that we made with Sonic Acts. And it's a dusty old book. I'll show it to you. It's a big, dusty book of Elliot Porter photographs. And I found this book in a used bookstore right when we arrived. And I have some history with large format photography. I began as a photographer and studied large format photography. And I have a sort of love for this kind of very technical photography, which is like perfect printing, like such attention to everything in the image. And so I flipped through this book, and most of these images really evoke delight for me. There's one in this book particularly of a roadrunner, the cactus, that just really speaks to me. But there's one image that I opened the book and I immediately felt horror and aversion to this landscape. And it happened to be the landscape that we're currently in. And it's a landscape that's very monochrome and it's very gray. And at a certain time of year, the forest is just a gray-purple tangle of brambles. And for me, this image evokes just a physical aversion to that space. And I had never experienced in nature a sense of aversion. I've always been drawn to nature and have gained so much inspiration from wild spaces. And it was strange to me that this particular landscape, my heart sort of rejected it. And I've been processing this of why should any landscape evoke aversion? And so it's a photograph from 1957 that really looks identical to the landscape outside of my window in November. And I thought to myself, I was like, Elliot Porter, why did you make this image? This is, what in this landscape speaks to you? Because I'm not getting it, Elliot Porter. So sort of my message to the past would be like, what is it in this landscape that could capture the heart of others? And why don't I feel it?
Not having your heart captured is a little different than aversion, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, like aversion for me is like disgust or even fear or it makes you want to flee, right?
Yeah.
But I mean, it also, to me, it looks kind of neutral in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And it evokes the neutrality of this place. But I think disgust is a very natural thing to feel. I don't think it's unnatural to feel aversion to a landscape, to feel that you're in the wrong place.
Hmm. Well, I don't think I've ever felt that before when looking at trees. I've never thought, I got to get out of here when I'm looking at a tree. But it's something about the uniformity of the landscape, and also the tangle of it. Like it immediately evokes feelings of like something like pulling on your hair or scratching your clothes, like something you can't get loose from, you can't move through the space. It's disorienting. So this, yeah, I found this image.
Do you want to hold it up
image.
To this?
Yeah, I'll show you.
That one, I don't know if you can see it, but it's,
So I've left this image open on my desk for a long time, just sort of meditating on it, wondering what it is in the image or, you know, by connection, the landscape that is a source of disconnect rather than connection. Just troubling myself basically with an image because I feel like there's something deeply inappropriate to not liking something natural. It just feels really ridiculous in a way. And this region is really known for its beauty. So for context, people will say, oh, you're in the Berkshires, it's so beautiful there. In a conversation, I would say, yeah, it's beautiful. And then secretly in my heart, I would think, I'm just not connecting to this beauty idea that everyone is mentioning. But there's something to that. There's a sense of loss, a sense of disconnection, and also a sense of being alien, I guess, having landed from a very different landscape sort of suddenly. Feeling of being alien in this ecosystem.
And, you know, just to connect that to what we were doing for the residency, we were really thinking about ambient contamination or kind of non-point source pollution, the sense that there can be pollution, you know, in the sense of like runoff from roads or just you know, something that is undetectable in the air, in the ground, in the groundwater, and in such minute amounts, but it's these toxic. So I think looking at an image of a landscape that where you can't put your finger on what it is that is so terrifying about it. Just something, some kind of horror in nature that is ambient, and is connected to a person and a place and time, I think. So both very specific and very ambient at the same time.
I like when, Luke, when you use the word seep, there's something about the image where you sense everything in the image is sort of just holding on for the next season. Like everything in the image has stored its nutrients and it's just surviving the winter in a sort of holding pattern. So it does make me think of periods of waiting or periods of illness or bodies in decline, and seeping is sort of like slow erosion or slow movement of time, a different kind of.
But that kind of dormant event. Period happens in the desert in a very different way.
Yeah.
It's really something to be just surrounded by death like that, or what appears to be death.
Well, I don't think it doesn't take me to death, but it takes me to illness or some kind of holding pattern. It definitely feels cyclical. It doesn't feel like an end point.
What I was wondering is, I mean, you said that you relocated, right, from Los Angeles during a period of wildfires there. And there is a similar, let's say, in terms of shape, right, what wildfires leave behind is also this landscape, very monochrome, kind of charred landscape with maybe these skeletons of trees, but that's a completely different moment.
Yeah, it's very different. I guess the puzzle is that, you know, I've always been quite drawn to landscapes. And even in California, a completely charred landscape is so fascinating for me. And it holds so much connection with that landscape. And then this one, I really look at it and I'm still trying to understand how everything works here. I look at the forest with really an utter state of confusion or just like, what is going on today? It's really foreign to me.
That kind of foreignness, I feel like it puts me in my place a little bit to be like, you don't understand the order of things here. And it's kind of presumptuous of you to think that you do understand the order of things. So sit back and like, and just try to listen to this. And that's what we've been doing since we got here, is just trying to listen to the order of things and like not just nature, but also people, and try to understand what the culture is. And it's totally opaque. And I think that this image approaches a kind of opacity and flatness. I think the idea of picking an artifact was actually really difficult for us. And Sarah mentioned a little bit about this, you know, the way that we haven't been in one place long enough to accumulate things, objects that had meaning. But there's also the sense that we have other objects that, or artifacts that are meaningful, you know, pieces of music or texts that they have this power. I think that we would worry about diminishing that power by examining them. The ones that we find most useful, that we carry with us and actually use, they have to remain opaque, and they have to not be broken down. I think we just have to leave them in their concentrated form. In the, you know, the other extreme is things that we just sort of pick up and carry with us very casually that, you know, are just remind us of something familiar, but don't really break down any further than that.
Yeah, we realized that, you know, there are certain things we use in the studio that propel energy and are like propelling the work, but there's something esoteric about them. Like, we want to protect those things. And yeah, I agree. Like, if we felt if we analyze them in this moment, they might cease to be useful. So we can't actually share those behind the scenes artifacts yet if they're still in use. Whereas this image, because we finished the piece for Sonic X, sentences about rivers and cancers, there's a kind of finality to looking at this photograph, because in a way I've processed it through that sound work. I've come up against that resistance that the image presented to me, and I've worked through that. So I have this comfort in looking at it now. But I think that something about the artifacts we use is that they sort of disturb us and they trouble us, and there's something energizing in that. And when it's midstream, when it's in the process, we can't present it yet. We're like, what is this? Why is this affecting me in my work right now? So there's almost something sacred about that. There's something esoteric about it, the power of objects when they're in use in that moment. And it can be completely neutralized when you come out the other side with a project.
I don't know if it's different for you as a photographer or with a history of working in photography to look at a photograph than it is for me. I mean, you see yourself in some ways questioning what made this guy take this picture. But for me, I feel like images can really sort of take the place of that kind of analysis. For some reason, like being in a text or being in a sound, you're already kind of performing this analysis because it's in the world with you in some way. But I feel like the image is, it's like a mark of another place in time that you really think about who was in this place looking at this and thought to capture it. I don't, maybe people feel that with like field recordings, but I feel like it's so in the way that kind of immersiveness, it invites you in and invites you to do that kind of analysis on your own to some extent, even if it's, you know, esoteric.
Well, I guess firstly, I wouldn't identify as a photographer. Weirdly, I'm you know, a sound artist or video artist who studied large format photography. I almost, you know, I left that space, but there's a level of care in making a large format photograph of using a view camera that's really methodical and careful. And it's something you look at every corner of the image and every plane you create and the space you create, and you have total control with a view camera over every detail rendered in the image. And then second to that, there's this process of selection that feels really different than in sound in a way, because each image is discrete and you're selecting from a pool of discrete samples of a landscape in a way. So it's not only why expose the plate here, why spend time here, but the selection baffles me. And the printing of it really amplifies all of the things I find difficult in the space, how it's printed really quite dark and low contrast, which just heightens that lavender gray. So there's so many stages of decision making in the image. And also recognizing like the mastery of Elliot Porter's practice of why why print this one so low contrast and amplify that aspect of the environment, which is both very ordinary and banal, zero drama there. And the only answer I can get to is that it really suggests the kind of quiet and aloneness that the landscape itself evokes. And it's not a loud statement, it's a completely quiet statement to make, that this landscape is nearly completely silent in the winter. and you would be the only like moving body in this field of vision. It's a strange statement to make amidst all the drama of like the American landscape to the left and right of it. So I think I just, with photography, large form of photography, I just recognize the level of care and detail and the process of selection. And that's why it's stuck with me in a way.
There is something that it reminds me of, and that is my experience of going to the forest in Finland, which is also very flat and ambient, if you can say that, in a sense that it seems to repeat itself, the landscape, but then because it's so flat, let's say, you start to notice different things about it. So the level of attention it requires, or the focus it requires, is different, which I also have this feeling from the photograph that you brought, and it changes a lot in like kind of subtle ways when the light changes, which I guess like printing something on such a low contrast also just reminds me of this feeling of like very slow light changes. And I guess these landscapes make you moved in a different way, right? But you need to get used to that.
In my childhood, there were these posters called the Magic Eye posters, where if you stared at them, it was an image would be revealed. It's a kind of social experiment in a way, where you see everyone else seeing it. And there's this like extreme desire to be in that place of observing that everyone else has achieved with the Magic Eye. And I remember I was usually the last to see it, and I would just try and try and try. I was like, what is in that image? It's a similar feeling with this forest and the repetition. It's a social experiment too, where you see others really enjoying this landscape and like seeing those details, pulling out those details. And then in myself, I've thought, well, I want to see it too. Like, it's a social experiment. I want to experience that wonder and that connection, and I'm not reaching it. So I'm going to keep looking over and over and over until I unearth that thing in the landscape that I connect to, like whether it's like a level of detail that I haven't experienced before, or the most minute bit of color that you can find, or an appreciation of the grayness of the quiet. So it was almost a social experiment to try to unlock something that I could see others seeing, but for whatever reason, I myself was not intuitively seeing.
And you've been collaborating for a long time, right? What does a relocation, or like a move to a different environment, what does that do to a collaboration? How did it change your ways of working?
You know, the ways that we work together has always been changing. Some of it is forgetting how we do things and then coming up with new ways. But also, like, you know, there's a lot of horror around collaborating. I think it's like, it's so difficult. And I think that's what makes it so worth preserving or working towards, is to kind of confront that difficulty, which is always present, I think, in sharing, you know, sharing an artifact or sharing a process with someone else, whether they're directly collaborating or whether they're audience or some other kind of responding in some way. I think there's this kind of untranslatable thing you're putting out there. And then I think maybe here, perhaps we're more comfortable with these untranslatable things, in the sense that we have decided to trust the way things go. But I don't know whether that's sort of instantly changed or whether it's been something that's been changing very slowly. But I would say that there's difficulty and there's trust, and it leaves things untranslated in a way that is keeps it going forward, I guess.
Yeah, I'm not sure how the move has altered. I guess I wouldn't say the move has altered the state of our collaboration. It's just, like you said, always changing and responding to circumstances. So in a way, this one doesn't feel peculiar. It just feels like part of an array of transformations that occur when a collaboration is not something I can own or any of my collaborators can own. It sort of exists in between everyone who gives input. And you just sort of watch it morph from all of those different perspectives. And it's odd. It's amazing to see ideas that are sort of birthed independently of your own ego or ownership, but you feel deeply committed to getting things right together. And I think the biggest thing to change is that our web of support is not only like physical, but it's been really like through correspondence and email and phone calls. And I think a lot of people are feeling this, that their webs of support during pandemic have almost transformed into language rather than touch, because you're not near your collaborators. So it's been interesting, for example, like the amazing vocalist we worked with on the Sonic Axe piece, Jess Basta. We worked with Jess through across a great distance for this project, but we have a history of having worked together and performed together and being proximate to each other. And when you make an artwork through email and through phone calls, it's very interesting how heightened language becomes when it's sort of minus gesture, minus touch, minus like facial expression, all those things that fill in our meaning. So I've been really acutely aware of words in this collaboration, and trying to use language precisely, which is always a big puzzle. So I think that's what has changed with not only relocating briefly, but just the conditions of the pandemic. How correspondence and virtual kinds of being together have morphed the practice.
I like this comparison that you made to the magic eye images. So this feeling of wanting to maybe become part of the audience that is already seeing, but yeah, you work with audience a lot, or challenging audience a lot in the work. Did that go through stages, or?
Yeah, it definitely has gone through many stages of thinking about what constitutes participation and what does participation look like, and expanding our definition of what participation looks like. In this piece, it's a discussion of the cancer experience, and I realized that in making this piece, how many people that experience touches and how infrequent it is that that experience is ever discussed sort of in the public. People will refer to relatives with cancer, but it's really rare that you sit at a coffee shop and speak in detail about what everyone went through and what the sort of texture of that experience was. And in making the piece and sort of giving voice to that experience, I recognize that every listener will have a relationship to cancer, that whether they've experienced it themselves, someone close to them will have experienced cancer treatment. So this feeling of really intimate connection is formed in thinking about the potential listener, as someone you're addressing the listener as someone who shares an experience with you, and just recognizing the like how many experiences connect with the cancer experience. And so that intimacy is a kind of participation that's really profound, to have that conversation with someone, even remotely, is quite close. And it's something invisible. You can't see that connection. You can't photograph it. So it's very different than some of our performance works that involve like touching someone or looking them in the eye or really physically engaging with another person closely. The voice somehow can carry all of that. So I guess I've thought about participation in ways that can happen asynchronously. Like I'm having a conversation across time with another person, and the response doesn't necessarily go one-to-one. But to me, the piece feels like a conversation that should be had in public and would be healing to have. So I hope it operates just like sitting down with someone and sharing that with someone.
Yeah, I think the idea of making something that's not universally legible it opens up the possibility for that sense of having a direct connection, maybe. Well, at the same time, kind of suppressing other kinds of accessibility. I think there is this sort of ideal possibility with sound or with music that you can make something that is multiply accessible, that you can have it be accessible to different people in different ways. But I think that kind of asserts this idea of the audience being generic in some way, even generically multiple. But I think that of there being like this kind of register that people sense resonating with their own experience, and embedding that in the sound I don't think we've tried that before, doing something that spoke directly to other people that had a similar experience.
Could you describe the process of making the piece and the piece briefly for listeners that haven't experienced it?
The sort of initial prompt that we gave ourselves was there's a shared kind of imaginary space between rivers and cancer, we're saying, that the way water moves is I'm just getting sort of tripped up on this, but it's like it's a strange kind of thing to think about, that in some ways our bodies are part of the watery ecosystem, but then you're most acutely aware of this when the pollution or the kind of toxicity that exists through your body and the kind of toxicity in the environment are linked in some way, whether it's through the causes of cancers or through the sort of after effects of cancer treatment, or the kind of other kinds of toxicity like financial toxicity, that can leave your own kind of environment depleted in other ways. That were very much like embedded in our landscapes. So working with this kind of assertion that, watery bodies and watery ecosystems were linked both sort of systemically, but also kind of in a shared kind of imaginary space. We're thinking about ways of kind of capturing that or communicating that through sound. So the two main things we did were to sort of extensively record the watershed that we're in, and all of the feeding waterways that come to this river that we spend a lot of time with. And then the other approach was to look at, you know, sort of more of a metaphorical watershed of all of the, all these kinds of texts and, you know, both from scientific literature, but also from illness narratives and, you know, illness poetry, things like that. And then also kind of some philosophy, a lot of kind of like hydrofeminism and drawing from all these different streams of thought and to come up with a text that was putting these texts side by side. So to think about, you know, a study of marine mammals who shared a certain cancer type with people who lived in the banks of the rivers where these mammals were, or in the same estuary, putting that alongside, I don't know, like Audre Lorde or Susan Sontag writing about illness.
The voice of the text is as if it's from a first person speaker, the voice you hear on the bridge in the Sonic Axe installation. But that voice is pulled from a whole library of texts that we gathered on illness and cancer narratives. Like Luke said, some of them scientific, some of them great poets like Audre Lorde, some of them serious like Susan Sontag. And we collected those texts and editing them. And at first that was a research process. And then we really realized the extent to which we leaned on these texts and they gave voice to the experience. So we had Jess Basta, amazing vocalist, work with those texts in weaving them into a kind of single narrator that holds so much. So many different perspectives are held in the narration. And then really listening to the water in this very watery environment that we're in. We're right along the banks currently of the Hoosick River on Stockbridge Munsee Mohican land. And we spent a lot of time recording the river and also paying deep attention to ambient pollution, runoff, the way water flows off of roads into the watershed, just sort of observing all these things and also thinking about cancer and blood and the lymphatic system and the way that tumors move and collect. And there were so many parallels, honestly, between observing ambient pollution, non-point source pollution in the environment, and also the difficulty of really locating causation in discussing cancer. There's such a complex web of causes. When we think of cancer, you can't really ever locate a single cause usually. And also thinking about time in each of those processes, how time operates, like time of exposure to toxics, the length of exposure and the sort of cascading effects after that. There are so many connections between thinking about the body and illness and the environment, thinking ecologically, that we wanted to weave that together. Rather than put a fine point on it, I think the text, because it's also a multi-channel piece, it can move in separate streams and your attention can move between parallel moments. So it also is a complex model of time and how things unfold, or at least that's what we tried to capture in the piece.
And on a more emotional level, I don't know if that's the right word, but I guess what I'm wondering is, how does time flow in the face of toxicity? Does that make sense?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. One really interesting thing is that exposure itself is not a determining factor. It's the time of exposure, like from the point in your human development, are you exposed as a child, as an adult? Like, where is your metabolism and your body at in the moment of exposure? And then also, it's rarely a single toxic. It's usually like multiple chemicals relating over time. So even in just a literal sense, time is everything in terms of exposure, and it really determines the extent of harm. So a lot of the research that we did was quite difficult, you know, looking at studies into different toxics and the effects of those toxics on human subjects. It's just, it was difficult, to be honest. It's really painful. But I wanted to understand just the extent to which timing is everything and how time relates in these processes. And it's similar looking at toxic exposure in human subjects or animal subjects or the health of watersheds. We sort of saw these parallels, just underscoring the role of time and sequence. And I think because we work in sound, we're very sensitive to thinking about order and sequence and duration. Those are the sort of conversations that are had around composition. So the fact that these are also sort of the framing, ways of framing illness and understanding toxicity and contamination was really interesting and familiar to us as sound artists, as a way of understanding these kinds of effects.
There's also this sense of crip time that many folks have written about, like Alan Samuels and Alison Kafer, as a way of kind of bending the clock, as Alison Kafer says. And it's this idea that disability and illness kind of take you out of normative time, or they sort of put you into a kind of time that is relational. It's sort of, you're dependent on others for, you know, mundane things like getting dressed in the morning or getting to appointments, but also that you're kind of drawn to these periodic systems of, you know, medication or treatment that sort of reset the way you move through time, and sort of being subject to all these different sort of barriers to smooth motion, but then also new ways of kind of adding cycles and periods to your life that are kind of dependent. It really does sort of bring about a new kind of time. And I think this is something that we were really interested in with the way time works in sound, that you can introduce these kinds of irregularities, obstructions, and kind of new cycles and repeating patterns. And it's not a far leap from thinking about that to thinking about the way the passage of water in a river is like all of what you hear when you're listening to a recording of the river is all of these kind of micro events of, you know, bubbles exploding when the water current hits a rock in a certain way. So the way that the water kind of erupts and then redirects, for me, was a very kind of sharp analog to the way crip time produces all these new sort of diversions and currents and tiny events that, you know, together make up this kind of noise. So I think we've heard so many recordings of water as water. And I think we really wanted to think about water as a way of, the sound of water as a way of presenting all of these, you know, the kind of compounding of events in a way that produces redirection and obstruction. Yeah, just thinking about what is it you're actually listening to when you listen to water. It's not, it's more than just this sort of abstract sense of a river. It's actually all these events.
Throughout the process of making the piece, we made sort of a rule that we have this library of field recordings of water, and we're never going to play them for you directly. You're never going to sort of listen to a direct hydrophone recording of water, because in a way, even in its most straightforward form, it's inaccurate. It's not how we think about water. So we use the recordings to drive other processes. So in a way, we're thinking of water as something that moves a process. And what is that process? What are we pointing to? So it's never a direct recording you hear. It's more that the recordings are used to drive other sounds and kinds of reactions.
Or as like a tool for analysis. We used a software library called Fluid Corpus Manipulation. Partly because the name was so perfect for
us. The name was exactly spot on.
But this is a library for analysis of sound. So we were using it to like kind of look through and find moments of change in the sound. When one sound changes to another, or kind of newness in the sound. Sound events that were unexpected. And then kind of highlighting that unexpectedness. So rather than thinking of the river as like a constant source of sound, like a forever sound, thinking of it as a producing newness and unexpectedness over and over.
Thank you for both strands of the conversation. Is there something you would like to add?
I think we've been working towards getting some kind of specificity, and that's kind of the thing that we're still struggling with. Especially in doing research or doing, doing things like a installation or performance or things like that. How do we kind of do something that's specific? Because we're always in dialogue with what we've done before, or like what our experience is, and people bring expectations and understandings of the situation.
My takeaway, it's funny. I feel like the project is finished, but the conversations that the project proposed are in process and in dispute and are changing. So for me, I feel, following this work, that there's more work to be done. There's sort of like to be continued. It suggests more.
That's a better way of putting it.
And for me, a lot of the work is very extremely visual. Even though we're working in sound, there are very strong images that I can't shake, that I can't get out of my mind. So it suggests to me there needs to be a new piece that includes image and sound. So I keep thinking, like, from this piece, the sort of next piece really includes video or performance. And so I'm not sure where that's going, but the piece has opened up so much that in a way a single artwork can sort of open up 10 other artworks. It's like a fractal is happening, and this is sort of our first piece that addressed the cancer experience and also thinks about water as a metaphor, but also as like as a physical and literal thing. There's a lot unfinished, and there's a lot left to research and discover following this process, is what I would say.